watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. We're told by the federal government that we must wage an endless war on terrorism to stop Osama bin Laden and his global secret network of followers from perpetrating more attacks upon the United States like those that happened 5 years ago on September 11th. We are told that bin Laden and his followers mounted these attacks because they hate the role the U.S. plays in the world. They hate its philosophy, and they see it as an obstacle to the world they wish to create based on fundamentalist Islamic beliefs. Because of the faith in those beliefs, bin Laden's followers will gladly give their lives, believing in a reward for their actions in the afterlife. It is believable that Middle Easterners would object to the role the United States has played in their region, toppling governments and installing others that benefit powerful American financial interests. Historically, many groups of various ideologies, desiring to prevail over a much more powerful adversary, have resorted to terrorism, if not on such a spectacular scale. Hell, even Americans unhappy with the government blew up a federal building in Oklahoma City, killing hundreds, remember? That event has quite a lot in common with 9/11. In both cases, the pattern of destruction of the buildings is not consistent with the official conclusions and points to prepositioned explosives placed inside the core of the buildings. In both cases, the official investigation refused to consider explosives inside the building and vilifies those who raise the question. In both cases, sweeping new laws were enacted shortly thereafter that gave the government more power to surveil and control Americans. And in both cases, some people in government received advanced warnings of the attack. And in both cases, a company called Controlled Demolition carted away the debris. New York City firefighters had reached the South Tower crash zone and believed they could put out the fires, but never had a chance because the tower collapsed, killing them all. If the towers had not collapsed, many trapped inside could even have been airlifted from the roof. Hundreds of witnesses, firefighters, police, building workers, journalists, bystanders, all heard and felt multiple explosions in the lower levels and basements of the buildings. Videos taken of the towers shows material ejected explosively from the buildings far below the crash areas. If you're a regular listener to this show, you've heard the many facts uncovered by independent investigators that contradict the theory of Osama bin Laden as the perpetrator. Clearly, his organization lacked the means and opportunity to effect controlled demolition of three skyscrapers and a stand-down of U.S. air defenses in the Northeast, the scheduling of more than a dozen simultaneous war games and hijack drills that created confusion in the skies over the Northeast and drew off Northeast-based fighter squadrons into Canada. If we change the scenario so that the invasion of various Middle Eastern countries under the rubric of the war on terrorism becomes the goal behind 9/11, not the response to it, the many facts that aren't explained by the Osama theory lead one to consider a different set of perpetrators and their motives. So get out your tinfoil hat. This week on the program, we'll look at who's been benefiting from the war on terrorism that would have not been politically possible without a catastrophic event like 9/11. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, quote, Iraq contains 112 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, the second largest in the world behind Saudi Arabia, along with roughly 220 billion barrels of probable and possible resources. Iraq's true potential may be far greater than this, however, as the country is relatively unexplored due to years of war and sanctions. Deep oil-bearing formations located mainly in the vast western desert region, for instance, could yield large additional oil resources, possibly another 100 billion barrels, but have not been explored, close quote. By my count, that makes 432 billion barrels times today's oil price per barrel, $67, something like $29 trillion. Trillions in oil revenues are not the only money to be made from the invasion of Iraq. The cost of the Iraq war to taxpayers was budgeted at over $318 billion. All of the weapons, uniforms, bases, vehicles, fuels, food and its preparation, all are purchased from private corporations. According to the National Priorities Project, a nonprofit that analyzes where federal dollars are spent, more than $28 billion of that total will be paid by the people of New York State. That $28 billion is enough to convert 93,743,138 homes to renewable electricity. According to the 2000 census, there were 105,480,101 occupied housing units in the United States. Just the money paid for the Iraq War by the people of New York State is enough to convert around 90% of American homes to renewable energy. The other 10%, the top 10, can afford to buy their own panels and windmills with their big tax cut. Wouldn't it be great if the people of New York refused to pay the $28 billion and instead bought panels and turbines for the nation? Talk about national security. Nuclear power plants, shut down. Coal-fired power plants, shut down. Gas-fired plants, shut down. No more electric bills. Could travel the country putting up solar panels and windmills, making a living and feeling good about it. With a project that big, might as well put in a factory or two to make some panels and windmills, which could go towards replacing some of the 187,000 manufacturing jobs lost in New York State in the past 5 years. Another world is possible if you get clear on who's with you and who's against you and have a serious talk with yourself about when enough is enough and what you are willing and able to do. Philip Berg is former Deputy Attorney General of the state of Pennsylvania and now a lawyer in private practice. He's been suspicious of the government's behavior since the morning of 9/11. He's filed RICO lawsuits on behalf of several survivors and 9/11 family members, citing Bush and other high government officials as complicit in the 9/11 attacks. He spoke last June at a conference in Chicago, 9/11, Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming Our Future. Here's Philip Berg.
On 9/11, on that particular day, I knew something was wrong. Three things struck my attention that day. The first, around 9:30 in the morning, when they told us that they showed us the video of Andy Card, the whispering in the president's ear. I think it's the resident's ear, I'm sorry. That a second plane had hit the World Trade Center and the country's under attack, and I saw no change in his facial expression, which meant to me he knew it. The second thing was the fact that after that message, which we were not told until about 20 minutes later, was relayed to the president, the law was broken. There's a law on the books that states that in the event of an attack on our country or an attempted assassination, the Secret Service is immediately to take the president, vice president, and other leaders in succession, immediately take them to a secret location that those individuals do not even know. That meant that initially, right away, if you think back now, there was a stand-down order right there, aside from what happened on the events of 9/11 with Bush, because I read someplace one police officer said to Secret Service, I guess you're leaving now, and not. They let him stay in that room reading a goat story to children, which really, in reality, if it was something they did not know about, the president, the children, the parents, the teachers, the press were all at risk. Think about that. Cheney was even taken out and put into the bunker under the White House. But when he sat there, that meant they knew about it. There was a stand-down order. That to me, right there, is indictable. Who knew that and what? The third thing that got my attention that afternoon, and I'm glued to the television 24/7, even before 9/11. I have a computer on my desk, and next to it I have my TV, which a lot of people say, well, you can't be watching news all the time, but I do. That afternoon, my office is in Lafayette Hill. I describe it as halfway between Philadelphia, where our nation was born, and Valley Forge, where our battle of freedom was won. But I saw, and from Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, it's like 300 miles away, but because of the proximity, it's still considered like a local market. So I'm not sure what I saw, if it was from a local or national TV. But on the afternoon of 9/11, I saw a female reporter. I don't remember the station. She's standing there. She says, I am standing here 5 miles from the crash scene in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Look behind me. And the camera panned back. Look behind me and look at the suitcases and other debris from that plane. Which meant that plane was shot down. That was the fact, because something crashing here does not bounce 5 miles. The engine was located a mile away. By the next day, that story disappeared. It was gone. 2 or 3 years later, Dom Giordano, a talk show host in Philadelphia radio, he had, I missed the show, but I heard that tomorrow he was going to do a show on the crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. I immediately called Dom, who I'd represented for years in many cases for free, up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, fighting funding for stadiums and all kinds of events, on his show many times, sometimes 3-4 times a week. I called and left a message on his voicemail. That's so terrific. You're doing this show tomorrow. I want to be on because I saw this female reporter, et cetera, et cetera. Dom never called me back, not only that day, hasn't called me in 3 years. The next day that show was canceled, was not run. He never did that show. It's just another aspect of the media holding things down. The significant is, and I'll get into my RICO suit in a minute, but Bush and his cronies, and you've heard variations of this, but this is what I basically say. Bush and his cronies either made 9/11 happen or let it happen. And if they let it happen, they made it happen. And if nothing else, they must be held responsible because of that. But on top of that, they have covered it up. And remember, Nixon went down on cover-up alone. So if we, together, we can really, we can get them. We can get them. Thank you. I have some prepared remarks here, which covers a lot of topics, and I think it'll be shorter than if I just free talk, because if I free talk, you'll turn me off after about 3 hours. Several days after the tragedy, rather murder, of 3,000 people, including people from about 89 countries, with the complicity of the United States federal government on September 11th. Another aspect of the tragedy was dealt to thousands of people. As you heard, the Environmental Protection Agency, Secretary Christy Todd Whitman, came to New York and told the people of New York and volunteers from around the world that had come in to help that the air is safe to breathe.
Oh, yeah.
How dare she? How dare she? And now we will jump ahead to what happened in 2005, the end. I forget the name, and I should know the individual. A fireman was the first individual to die from that, with effects of the environmental issues that were there. Last year, I was on the Jimmy Walter tour of Europe trying to set up an international commission, and Rachel Hughes was there with us. And Rachel had only volunteered at the site for 3 days. She's now on breathing apparatus. she got that sick. There are thousands and thousands. And the New York authorities, the police department, fire department, they will not even give workmen's compensation. They're taking a position that these health problems had nothing to do with 9/11. Now, one thing good is there's, aside from my lawsuit, there's several others, but there's a lawsuit pending in the same district. We're now in the Southern District of New York. And there, the judge in the environmental case dealing with Ground Zero really chastised the government about six, seven weeks ago. And the significant part of that is, which I am hoping in my case we'll get to one of these days, is the fact that that federal judge, she has granted discovery in that case. And that's the key to moving forward. So that's very significant because now, even though she's doing the environmental issues, perhaps we'll be able to get information on that. But I'm hopeful in the RICO case that it's been sitting in the courts on another motion to dismiss. I've been fighting them for 4 years. They keep trying to throw me out, and I keep trying to stay in. But if we can ever get that, and I'm hoping because the judge on my case is in the same courthouse as the judge in the environmental, and hoping they talk. And more we have these type of events and more information comes out, I think it's helpful to the RICO suit because one of these days someone's going to say, you know, open up. See, I've always said to Bush and the, you know, and the pass it back, whoever you are in here, pass it back, or because we know everything being said here goes right to the White House. If who's the representative? You got guts enough to tell me today, or you don't?
Mess up.
Oh, if anyone's being wiretapped and followed, it's me, okay? and I'm not afraid because Bush and Cheney belong in jail for murder and treason. And I say words to that effect in my lawsuit, and you can check that out. But Whitman's statements going back, along with the safeguards that were not put in place, means there's absolute liability on the United States federal government in that environmental issue. September 11th was a day that changed the course of history, an environmental disaster of epic proportions and a tragedy that is the most significant event of our lifetimes. When the World Trade Center fell, you heard of the materials that were showered down on people. You know, from the fluorescent lights, from the computers, from the fire alarm systems, everything there. But the government says no health problems. My client is a hero and victim, William Willie Rodriguez. He suffers today. Also, he doesn't talk that much about it from the permanent health injuries he sustained. Mr. Rodriguez, right now, I heard from someone here, is in Malaysia. He's been traveling around the world. He's been traveling a lot with Jimmy Walter, trying to promote an international commission. Willie's a hero because he helped save hundreds of people's. As Willie was the porter in the building for 20 years, he was late for work that day. We're glad, because if he wasn't late for work, he would have been up at the windows of the world, on the top, and we would not have heard from Willie in. He had the master key. Remember, fire doors open out. So if you go up a fire escape, you really can't get in. He had the master key, and he went up with firemen opening the fire doors to let firemen in. Willie, significant, is he heard explosions in the building before the first plane hit the North Tower. Right. Willie testified before the 9/11 commission. There's nothing to that effect in the final report. Willie is lucky, and so are we. He was the last person out of the World Trade Center. He dove under a fire truck, and he thought that was it, but he did survive. The Rachel Hughes I mentioned and these other health problems, I said they're not granting the fact that it's workman's comp or anything related. Not only that, they're not even giving them benefits. They're not covering them. Rachel has to, like, beg, basically, for coverage. This is just the lies of the Bush administration, and they must be held responsible because they committed many crimes. I always ask people, wherever I go, whether it's a conductor, whether it's a waiter, waitress, anyone, do you think the government told us the truth about 9/11? I've been doing this for 5 years. 90% of the people I contact say, absolutely not, they lied. There were many crimes that committed on that day. I'm going to try to skip some pages in here. I have a RICO lawsuit. It's filed against Bush and 54 other defendants, including Bush Sr., Cheney, Ashcroft, Condoleezza Rice. Remember, she knew nothing about it till the September 7th memo came out. I believe that the case I'm working on is the most significant case in our history. RICO is a racketeering statute, Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organization Act. It was created in the 1960s by the United States Congress to go after the mafia or the mob. It's our position that there's a mob in the White House, and with your help, we're going to get them. Thank you. I stated that Congress created RICO, and Congress is violating their oath of office by not holding impeachment proceedings against George W. Bush and Cheney for their lies about September 11th and weapons of mass destruction that got us into the illegal war in Iraq. Not one service personnel should have ever died in Iraq. We had no business being there. In my RICO lawsuit, I'm alleging foreknowledge, failure to warn, failure to prevent, and cover-up. And as I stated before, Nixon went down and cover-up alone. David Ray Griffin stated that the 9/11 Commission report is a lie and cannot be believed, and that high government officials were complicit. Griffin has also said to me, quote, that the RICO lawsuit that I filed is the vehicle to reveal the falsity of the September 11th Commission report. We believe that Bush will be invoking a long-standing rule of executive privilege and sovereign immunity, and I promise to you I will fight them to the end on that, because you cannot hide when you murdered 3,000 people, and this government did it. Also, we must unite, and I'm talking twofold. We must unite with all the 9/11 people, because as well as this conference is, and it's beautiful, there's still dissension in the ranks, and we have to unite. Also, we have to go out and not beg, but we have to tell them. The anti-war people, who basically want nothing to do with us, wake up, anti-war people. If you didn't have 9/11, you wouldn't have a war. Yeah. And I believe I would like to have a confrontation with some of the leaders of the anti-war, because I believe that they are infiltrated, and I believe that's why the resistance us. There's no reason that we're not all together. And there's other splinter groups around this country against Bush for so many reasons. We have to unite. We need a peaceful revolution to take over this country, to take back what has been taken away. This administration has done more to take away individual rights than any other administration in 225 years, and we should not stand for that. Now, I have a lot of things on the axe. I'm going to move on. If I have a chance, I'll do that. But I want to bring up some very significant things that happened on that day. Let me find it right here. Two huge mistakes by the proponents of the official story. One is the interview of Mayor Rudolph Giuliani by Peter Jennings, and I have the tape. It's upstairs. In that interview, you have the cut here, yeah. If we have time. Mayor Giuliani described how he had been in a command center on Barclay Street, and not that million-dollar complex that they created in Building 7. My first question is, because he states he went down there after the first hole in the building, so he's there before or around 9 o'clock. And nothing had collapsed at that point. So why did he not go to Building 7? I submit to all of you that Building 7, and I needed some engineer or someone to figure it out, if the flight path. Building 7, I think, was a target for another plane. And Flight 90, no. I don't think 93, because that was too far away. I think it could have been that. We know there were at least 7 other planes off course that morning, up to 16. There's different variations. Giuliani testified there were 11 planes off course. Because that building was pre-wired, and if a plane had hit it, they wouldn't have to be doing the double talk they are now. Why did they drop Building 7? Building 7, like the North and South, was pre-wired, so that's why they had to drop it later in the day, because I think if anyone walked in there, they could have touched off the explosions. But in that, the significant thing is a worker told Giuliani that he must evacuate because the World Trade Center was going to collapse. The late Peter, I have the interview. If we have time, we'll play that. This is a huge admission and evidence of crimes. No steel and reinforced concrete skyscraper ever collapsed before or since, except for those three, due to fire. This warning to Giuliani was in no uncertain terms. He was told there would be a collapse, so he evacuated. He says, well, we got caught in, you know, and we had a trap for a few minutes. This tells us two things. One, some emergency personnel had foreknowledge of a historically unprecedented occurrence, a steel skyscraper collapsing due to fire. This is virtually sure proof of controlled demolition. And the worst nightmare for Bush, oh, he has a lot of nightmares, but the worst is Madrid, Spain, 2005, a 50-story building totally engulfed, burned out of control for 24 hours, totally gutted, and I happened to see it myself when I was in Spain last year, still standing. Concrete and steel buildings do not come down from fires. The second thing, and this deflates Giuliani as a hero and shows the cynicism and brutality of his masters, and I think it should be mentioned throughout this country because he's talking about running for president. Giuliani was warned. Giuliani got his ass out of there. But the police and firefighters were not warned, which is to say they were slaughtered. As singer Bruce Springsteen said, love and duty call to the firefighters, and greed and murder call to the traitors that killed them. Ladies and gentlemen, we together, all of us, must be focused upon the issues of our time to come together hand in hand for a peaceful revolution, to end the cover-up, to regain our rights, and end the war in Iraq. We must all hang together or we'll hang separately. It's the only way to overthrow an entrenched dictatorship. Thank you.
That was Philip Berg, a former Pennsylvania Deputy Attorney General, now an attorney in private practice, speaking about his RICO lawsuit filed on behalf of 9/11 survivor Willie Rodriguez. About 100 people skeptical of the government version of 9/11 and who want to put an end to the so-called war on terrorism are running for Congress this November. One of them is Dr. Robert Bowman. He is the Democratic candidate in Florida's 15th District, though he said he was once a conservative Republican. Bowman served as a combat pilot in Vietnam and culminated a 22-year Air Force career as a lieutenant colonel and director of Advanced Space Programs Development for the Air Force Space Division. In that capacity, he controlled about $500 million worth of space programs, including the then-secret Star Wars programs under the Ford and Carter administrations. He holds a Ph.D. in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from Caltech and has consulted and taught all over the world. He now directs a nonprofit he founded, Institute for Space and Security Studies. Its mission described as follows, quote, "We are devoted to true security for the American people. This includes global security, peace through law, economic security, economic justice, human rights, environmental security, and health security. We pursue these goals through public education and nonviolence," close quote. Bowman is also presiding Archbishop of the United Catholic Church, an independent Catholic denomination that allows married clergy and the ordination of women and gay men in monogamous relationships. Robert Bowman has become very active in the 9/11 truth movement, and what we're going to hear next is an excerpt of his speech to the closing plenary of a conference held in Chicago last June titled 9/11, Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming Our Future, sponsored by 9/11truth.org and MUJCA, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance. Here's Robert Bowman.
Thank you very much. I keep showing up at these things. Toronto, New York, Washington, Chicago, wherever. They tell me you don't have to be a rocket scientist to run the government. Nevertheless, I am one. And although I'm running for Congress from the 15th District of Florida against an incumbent Republican, which I will not name, there's a lot of things that I want to do when I get there. There's several of us running who have agreed that our first piece of legislation that we will co-sponsor will be articles of impeachment. Right up at the top of my list of things to do in Washington is to take the 9/11 truth movement mainstream. It's time this movement moved out of rented hotels and into the halls of Congress. Now, I'm not going to go through a long list of reasons why I think 9/11 is an inside job. If you guys here don't think that by now, too bad. I think that would be carrying coals to Newcastle. I will say, because of my personal experience and personal knowledge as an old interceptor pilot, that I have some idea of what should have gone on that morning of 9/11. I know the drill. I know how long it takes. I've flown those missions. And I don't blame the interceptor pilots that morning. I've looked at the timelines, and I think they did their best under the circumstances. they would have intercepted whatever it was hit those buildings if they had been notified on time. A lot of people say that our government was warned. They knew this was going to happen, and they did nothing. That is not true. If they had done nothing and just let normal procedures take their place, those twin towers would still be standing and thousands of dead Americans would still be alive. Now, sometimes when backed into a corner, they try and say, well, it was just incompetence. You know, somebody screwed up. Yeah, they should have notified and scrambled those aircraft as soon as these things went off course, as soon as they lost radio communication, as soon as the IFF transponder failed. Any of those three things should have triggered an immediate call for intercept. Any one of those three things. They all happened, and time went by, and time went by. And those things flew around up there for about an hour and a half. If they had just twiddled their thumbs for 20 minutes and scrambled those jets, they could have intercepted whatever hit the Trade Center before it happened. Now, if this is incompetence, why hasn't anybody been fired, demoted, court-martialed? Now, the people who really had the responsibility that were in the right place to stop this have all been promoted or given the Medal of Freedom. This was not incompetence, it was treason. Now, I've been asked to put this in a broader context, relate it to other issues affecting our country. And, of course, that's what I have to do as a candidate for Congress. I have to relate it to all the other issues. And I think it's important that we understand that 9/11 was not an isolated incident in our history. It is related to a lot of other things, and it's related to the situation that we're in right now, and it's related to our very standard of living. Let me give you just some examples here. First, I got to tell you, the United States is number one. Number one in the industrialized world. Number one in our use of the world's resources. Number one in the production of pollution. Number one in the gap between the rich and the poor. Number one in deaths by gunfire. Number one in teen pregnancy. Number one in poverty among the elderly. Number one in citizens without health coverage. Number one in child poverty. Number one in homeless veterans. And number one in citizens behind bars. We're the number one debtor nation in the world. We're number one in the creation of new billionaires. Number one in school dropouts. Number one in poverty, homelessness, hunger, divorce, suicide. And oh yes, number one in military force, nuclear weapons, and military spending, about as much as the rest of the world combined. This, of course, also makes us number one target of object of fear and hatred in the world, and therefore the number one target of terrorists, along with our allies in Israel. We also lead the world in the number of hours worked per family. real hourly wages are now about a third of what they were in the 1950s. Ordinary folks in this country don't realize that. They don't understand how we are being stolen from. But think about it. Those of us who grew up in the 1950s supported our families with one job, working 40 hours a week. My kids can't do that. You have to have two wage earners a family. One of them has to have two jobs. And still, they're just trying to squeak by. If ordinary people in this country, working people, got the same percentage of the wealth that they create as we got in the 1950s, people today, because of gains in productivity, we could all support our families with one wage earner, one job, working 2 days a week. We have been conned and lied to about a lot of stuff, and 9/11 is only one of the latest. If worker pay in this country had kept pace with executive pay, the average worker would now be making over $1 million a year, and the minimum wage would be $171 an hour. Now, in its phony war against the terrorists, which its own policies have created, our government has overturned the constitutional protections given us by our founding fathers in the Bill of Rights. In its drive toward a corporate New World Order, it has sold out our workers, our families, our environment, our children's futures, and the American dream, and it has protected their power with 9/11. Now, what went wrong? Why are our workers paid such a tiny percentage of their true worth? What's going on here? The answer is, we have lost our republic. Legislators no longer represent the people who elect them, but the corporations who finance them. They no longer answer to their constituents, but to the lobbyists who line their pockets and fill their campaign coffers. In return, government officials have undone decades of hard-fought victories against the robber barons of the 19th century. For years now, the world's billionaires have directed U.S. policy for their own personal profit. This has included agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA and the World Trade Organization, falsely portrayed as supporting free trade, but in reality promoting free investment, overturning U.S. laws, and putting American workers in competition with those in the third world. That's one reason our wages are so low. It has also resulted in a series of wars from Iraq to Bosnia to Kosovo to Afghanistan to Iraq again, wars which are never in the interest of those fighting them or of the families left behind, wars which only serve the insatiable greed of the global investor class. And when they made their plans for the invasion of Iraq, and they made them in the 1990s, and they published it in black and white, they said in their planning document, the American people will never go for this, unless, to use their words, there's a new Pearl Harbor. And that was 9/11. There is a connection between 9/11 and our economic situation. There's a connection between 9/11 and the fact that the rich keep getting richer and the rest of us keep falling by the wayside. We now have a government which serves the interests of giant agribusiness, giant pharmaceutical companies, giant insurance companies, giant weapons manufacturers, giant oil companies, and all the other global robber barons of the 21st century. Losing out are the rest of us. Increasing numbers of American families in poverty, immigrants working for slave wages, small businesses forced into bankruptcy, seniors unable to afford their medications, disappearing family farmers, what's left of a dwindling middle class, and especially our brave young men and women sent around the world to kill Arabs for the oil companies. Corporate power over our political system, over the media, and over most aspects of our lives is the greatest danger we face today. And that corporate danger, those renegade billionaires and their hirelings in Washington cemented their power and brought about their plans for imperial conquest by giving us 9/11. Curtailing this power and restoring it to we the people is our greatest challenge. Those of us who dedicate our lives to truth, peace, economic justice, and environmental preservation can make little progress in our struggles so long as ultimate power is in the hands of those who profit from deceit, war, poverty, and pollution. And they are the ones who brought us 9/11 and who attempt to control every aspect of our lives. And I'm among one of about 100 non-politicians, combat veterans all, who are running for Congress. We're Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Libertarians, Independents, but we are united by the fact that we want to take back America, we want to bring home our troops from Bush's quagmire, and we want to expose the lies that it was based on, including 9/11. The immediate need is to outlaw all means of voting which do not result in a paper ballot which can be counted, recounted, and audited as necessary. Without that, everything else is meaningless. But then we also need instant runoff voting, proportional representation, making Election Day a federal holiday, true campaign finance reform, getting rid of burdensome requirements which tend to inhibit the power of third parties and independents. Yeah. And truly nonpartisan apportionment. Whatever it takes, we must once and for all sever the connection between big money and political power.
You've just been listening to an excerpt from Dr. Robert Bowman's speech to the closing plenary of 9/11, Revealing the Truth, Reclaiming Our Future, held last June in Chicago. Last week, Bowman won his primary contest to become the official Democratic Party candidate for Florida's 15th district. The major area newspaper, the Orlando Sentinel, endorsed Bowman's opponent. Here's what they wrote, quote, "Opponent Bowman is a retired military officer and nuclear scientist from Melbourne. His positions, such as nearly tripling the minimum wage, would be a hard sell in the conservative 15th district, which covers part of Brevard, Osceola, and Polk counties, and all of Indian River County. And he insists there is evidence of U.S. government complicity in the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Close quote. Bowman has a website, bowman2006.com. That's bowman2006.com. And speaking of practical strategies to end corporate domination, next month, October 13th through 15th, there will be an event held in Manhattan's financial district that strikes at the very heart of the wage slave system. It's a national summit of the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, formed in 2004, and members of the public are invited to take part. A good place to learn about starting a worker co-op for yourself. The regional field administrator of one of the AFL-CIO's largest unions recently proposed that its members use worker cooperatives as an alternative organizing strategy, describing co-ops as an alternative that reaches outside the limitations of unions, converting workplaces into democratically run institutions owned by the workers. Worker co-ops have a long history in the U.S. The first such were in the American colonies, started by immigrants in New York and Philadelphia, whose only alternative to their horrible working conditions was to walk off the job and set up shop together. Union organizing came later. Today, no one knows how many worker co-ops there are in the U.S., because until recently they had made little effort to organize. But several years ago, regional and local networking among co-ops began to accelerate. Worker co-ops from all over the U.S. and abroad will be at the meeting next month in New York. Among them, San Francisco's Rainbow Grocery, which has 200 worker owners and is a pioneer in fair trade products. There will be rural home care and taxi cab co-ops from Wisconsin, preschool co-ops from Philadelphia, and many restaurants, including one of the conference venues, Colors, a popular eatery in the East Village whose worker owners include former employees of Windows on the World Trade Center restaurant. And presenters will include co-ops from Argentina, Venezuela, and New Orleans, as well as a variety of experts, advisors, and facilitators. So if you're thinking of forming a co-op, or want to know more about it, more info is available on the web at usworker.coop. That's not .com, that's .coop. usworker.coop. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. The themes of control of the media and government by corporate interests and who had a motive to want an event like 9/11 will be explored in depth by our next speaker, Dr. Peter Phillips, who also spoke at the 9/11 conference in Chicago. Phillips is professor of sociology at Sonoma State University in California and directs Project Censored, which each year identifies the top 10 stories unreported or underreported by the corporate media. He's been heading up a special research project on what he calls the Global Dominance Group, those who are benefiting most from 9/11 and are the prime movers of the so-called war on terrorism. He begins by describing how Project Censored got involved in the 9/11 truth movement.
We're a media research group that for 30 years is putting out a list of the most important news stories that the corporate media hasn't covered. So that got us interested in 9/11 unanswered questions right away. Our book in 2003 which came out actually just about a year after 9/11, listed everything that we'd seen at that point that looked like very serious, well-documented, unanswered questions. And we took that even further last year in our book, which is the one that's out right now, 2006. This has a full chapter, Unanswered Questions of 9/11, and it talks about odd as money and Building 7 and all of those things, most of which people here today, after a couple of days of this, are pretty familiar with. One thing that became interesting to me early on and fit into the kind of research I do, I do political research about power elites and have looked at higher class policy councils and groups in the U.S. who kind of are the decision makers, the ones making the decisions in the United States. And I've traced their histories and looked at a long 100-year history of post-industrialization and policy councils going back to the national manufacturers and then the Trilateral Commission, all these different groups. And they're all interesting. They're all elite policy planning groups. But what's happened relative to 9/11 and before is a significant shift in the power base within the policy groups in the United States. And that was very interesting to me because as I was traveling with Barry Zwicker a year ago when his movie broke in the Bay Area and we went to five cities in a row and I was on a panel with him, Webster, Barry, Ian, a lot of people I was working with were saying they did this. They are the ones that did this. But who they were, you know, it was always implied Bush or Cheney or, you know, and if you took Michael Rupert's stuff all the way out, he was saying Cheney in the basement of the White House and the war games and that kind of stuff. But any support for that, the evidence for that was pretty thin. And so I wanted to, we really wanted to put, you know, some parameters on and some definition of who they are. Who are the people in power? Who are the decision makers? So we started kind of a network analysis where we take a look at who the beneficiaries are from 9/11, who were the advocates before. We look at the history of the neocons, and we put together a list, which is available here, and it's on our website at projectcensored.org, of 240 key players in what we call the global dominance group. And the global dominance group is somewhat different because after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the deterioration of the Soviet Union, this whole fear of communism, which had galvanized the policy elites in this country since World War II, went away rather quickly. And there was a real push at that time to decide, well, where do we go from here? And what have been our strategies? Our strategy has always been detente, mutually assured destruction between the Soviet Union and the U.S., statesmanship and that. So we see an emergence then where the leadership class in the United States becomes dominated by a neoconservative group of people who have a shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. So our research identifies the key actors in this global dominance group, examines how they are interconnected, how they are supported by the corporate media, and how these key newsmakers use public relation firms to put their agendas out. And we review who benefited after 9/11, and we examine how Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld as the most public figures of this group, but how they're interlocked in public-private partnerships with the corporate media, with private foundations, the military contractors, policy elites, government officials, and that collectively, in a very tight group, they support the U.S. military global domination of the world. So this is why we call them global dominance group. Now, Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle, they came out of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought, Leo Strauss, and you know, had this neoconservative philosophy, but they were few in number. But the philosophy is somewhat interesting. I want to give some examples of that. Adbusters magazine defined neoconservatism as the belief that democracy is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion. And only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. And such a nationalism requires an external threat, and if one cannot be found, it must be manufactured. So this belief, you know, that the people in the country will go along with and want to defend our nationalism is very present. And John Pilger wrote, he had actually interviewed Richard Pearl back during the Reagan administration. And this is his quote. He said, "I interviewed Pearl when he was advising Reagan. And he spoke about total war." This was back then. "And I mistakenly dismissed him as mad." He was writing this about 2 years ago. And he said, "And recently he used the term in describing America's war on terror. No stages," Pearl said. "This is total war. We're fighting a variety of enemies. There are lots of them out there. All this talk about we're going to do Afghanistan, then we'll do Iraq, and it's entirely wrong. You know, we just let our vision of the world go forth. We embrace it entirely. We don't try to piece together clever diplomacy. We just wage total war. Our children will sing great songs about us in the future." So that's Pearl. I mean, 10 years ago, during the Reagan administration. So clearly within that, and when Bush was elected to the presidency, then Cheney became Secretary of Defense, Bush the first. So the expansion, the neoconservatives were starting to be placed in positions of power within the government within Bush the first administration. And by 92, Cheney, using Lewis Livy and Paul Wolfowitz and other writers, had produced what was called the Defense Planning Guidance Document. This was an internal memorandum circulated with the Pentagon and in high government officials that advocated the U.S. military dominance of the globe in a new world order. That's when that terminology first started. Now, if you remember Bush talking about a new world order back during Gulf War I, I mean, that was kind of the origin of it, this new world order, U.S. to dominate the world. But what was interesting, you know, and it called for words we hear today, unilateral action, forward presence of troops worldwide. That was, you know, and the U.S. was to dominate friends and foes alike so that we'd be stronger, literally, militarily, than anybody else in the world. Even if they're our friends, you know, you don't know that, you know, maybe the French next year won't go along with what we want. I mean, so anybody, we needed to be stronger so that we could threaten literally anybody in the world. Well, the Defense Policy Guidance Document was leaked to the press. And, you know, and people were kind of in shock about it. The New York Times wrote on March 11th, 92, that senior White House and State Department officials have harshly criticized a draft Pentagon policy statement that asserts America's mission in the post-war era, prevent any collective friendly or unfriendly nations from competing with the United States for superpower status. So the New York Times is saying, hey, this isn't a good idea. Bush kind of backs off on that as a strategy. And then, of course, Clinton, who was never supposed to get elected, got elected. And so these guys are basically out of government. There were some neocons, Woolsey and others, within the Clinton administration, but it wasn't a predominant thing. So Clinton kind of stays away from promoting global dominance as an ideological justification for continued high defense budgets. In the early 90s, there was this talk of a Cold War dividend, you know, that we were going to have money for schools and for the economy, and that didn't last very long. But the defense spending went down a little bit. It dipped a little bit. And Cheney had actually did that. It was symbolic. But we see kind of a maintenance. But Clinton's strategy for helping the defense contractors at that time was to actively pursue the expansion of U.S. weapon sales worldwide. So we went from 16% of the international weapon sales in 1988 to 63% in 97. Remember Ron Brown before they got his airplane? And I mean, he was going around promoting arms sales for the defense contractors all over the world. So the neoconservatives, you know, they were still very active during the Clinton administration, but most of them ended up in various conservative think tanks or working for Department of Defense contractors. So they moved into the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institute, GENSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security, Center for Security Policy, and others. And so they're employed there. They're working, writing papers, and doing advocacy for the continued military New World Order advocates.